So in 2007, American banks held about $15 billion in reserve at the Federal Reserve,
Right.
which sounds like a lot. But 7 years later, in 2014, they held $2.7 trillion.
Yeah, trillion with a T.
Trillion. And I want to be clear, that isn't a typo. 15 billion to 2.7 trillion.
It's just staggering.
It really is. It's this massive structural explosion that completely broke the engine room of the United States economy. And the crazy part is, if you're listening to this and you paid way too much for an economics textbook in college, it probably hasn't updated its glossy charts to reflect that this even happened.
No, probably not.
Hey.
I mean, it is the absolute definition of a paradigm shift hiding in plain sight.
Right.
What we are looking at today is a fundamental transformation in how monetary policy is actually implemented in this country. You assume the mechanics of the financial system are just fixed, right?
Right.
That the foundational rules don't just change overnight.
But they did.
They absolutely did.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because our mission today for this deep dive is to explore a fascinating explainer piece from the St. Louis Fed, and it's titled The Fed's New Monetary Policy Tools. We're going to dive into how the U.S. Central Bank just completely rebuilt its operating system.
Yeah, and the stakes here really touch every single aspect of the economy. I mean, by law, the Federal Reserve has a dual congressional mandate, right?
Right, maximum employment and price stability.
Exactly. They have to promote maximum employment and they have to maintain price stability. Essentially, their job is keeping the economy from running too hot with inflation or running too cold into a recession.
Which is a tough balancing act.
Very. And historically, they achieve those goals through a system that was entirely dependent on the concept of scarcity.
But not anymore.
No. Today, they've quietly transitioned to a system driven by overwhelming abundance.
Well, to really appreciate this new world of abundance, I think we first have to understand the old machinery, right?
Yeah, definitely. We need to go back.
Let's go back to that pre-2008 scarcity model. Because if you took an economics class before the financial crisis, or even recently with a professor using an outdated syllabus, you were taught a very specific story about how the Fed controls interest rates.
Right. Prior to 2008, the Fed operated what is now called a limited reserves framework.
Limited reserves.
Exactly. And understand this, we kind of have to look at the daily life of a traditional bank back then.
Okay.
By law, banks were required to hold a certain percentage of their customers' deposits as cash in reserve.
Just sitting there.
Right. They could keep this as literal vault cash or as deposits in an account at a Federal Reserve bank.
Yeah.
And these were known as their required reserves.
And naturally, I mean, you'd think a bank might hold a little extra cash just to be safe, right? What they call excess reserves.
In theory, yes. But in practice, historically, they held almost zero excess reserves.
Really? Zero.
Almost zero. And the reason comes down to basic profit motives. The Federal Reserve at the time did not pay any interest on those reserve balances. So having extra cash sitting in an account at the Fed was essentially a lost opportunity to make money. A bank's entire business model is putting money to work by lending it out.
Right. Every dollar sitting idle at the central bank was a dollar not earning interest from, a mortgage or a business loan.
Exactly. So banks kept their reserves as close to the legal minimum as physically possible.
Which meant the actual pool of cash floating around the banking system was incredibly tight.
Extremely tight.
Money was genuinely scarce.
Highly scarce. Now think about the sheer volume of transactions a major bank processes every single day.
Millions of checks clearing, massive wire transfers.
ATM withdrawals, all of it. Because the margins were so tight, a bank would often get to the end of the business day and find themselves a little short of their legally required reserves.
Oh.
Yeah, and when that happened, they had to scramble. They would turn to other banks who happened to have a slight surplus that day, and they would borrow money overnight just to meet their reserve requirement.
And that marketplace where banks lend to each other overnight, that's the federal funds market, right?
Yes, the one.
And the interest rate they charge each other for those overnight loans is the famous federal funds rate, or FFR.
Exactly. That federal funds rate is the primary policy rate. That is the ultimate steering wheel the Fed uses to influence the entire U.S. economy.
Right.
If the Fed wants to cool down a booming inflationary economy, they want that federal funds rate to go up,
Right.
which makes borrowing more expensive across the board.
And if they want to stimulate a sluggish economy, they want that rate to go down to encourage lending and investment.
Spot on. And this is key. The Fed didn't just snap their fingers and dictate that rate.
They couldn't just decree it.
No, they had to manipulate it indirectly using supply and demand. And this is where the scarcity part becomes so crucial.
Okay, lay it out for me.
Because reserves were so limited, the Fed used a tool called open market operations. Every single day, the trading desk at the New York Fed would buy or sell U.S. Treasury securities on the open market.
So if the Fed wanted to lower the interest rate, they would buy a few billion dollars worth of Treasury securities from the banks.
Right.
And they paid for those securities by instantly adding newly created reserves into the banking system.
Exactly. More supply of reserves meant the price to borrow them, which is the interest rate went down.
And conversely, if they wanted to raise the rate, they sold securities, taking cash out of the system, shrinking the supply, and driving the borrowing rate up.
That's the mechanism.
And there was a fail-safe built into this too, right? The discount window?
Yes, the discount rate acted as a kind of structural ceiling for the federal funds rate.
How so?
Well, if a bank absolutely couldn't find another bank willing to lend to them overnight, they could go directly to the Federal Reserve and borrow cash at the discount rate.
Ah, okay.
But the Fed intentionally set this discount rate higher than their target federal funds rate.
Okay.
Because of that, it functioned as a natural ceiling.
Right, because no rational bank manager would ever pay a competitor a 5% interest rate if they could just go borrow directly from the Fed at 4%.
Exactly. Why pay more?
So I want you to really picture this old system as you're listening. Imagine the entire U.S. reserve economy is just a very, very small room.
Right, that.
And the Federal Reserve is trying to control the temperature in that room. Because the room is so small, because those reserves are kept so strictly limited by the banks, the Fed barely has to do anything to change the temperature.
Right.
They just crack a window open a tiny bit, letting a little puff of air in or out. Those are the daily open market operations. And instantly, the temperature of the whole room changes.
That temperature being the federal funds rate.
Exactly.
It's a great analogy. Because if we look at the traditional textbook charts, this entire mechanism relied on the supply curve of money intersecting the steep downward sloping part of the demand curve.
The steep.
Yeah, when you are operating on a steep cliff, even a microscopic shift to the left or right drastically changes your elevation.
Mm-hmm.
Scarcity was the engine of control. The Fed fine-tuned the supply of reserves by just a few billion dollars a day, and the bank's desperate daily demand to meet their strict reserve requirements did the rest.
And then 2008 happens.
Yes, 2008.
The housing market collapses, the global financial system freezes, and that small room analogy we just built, the walls get completely blown out.
Just demolished. I mean, the 2008 financial crisis was a systemic shock of unprecedented magnitude. Credit markets completely froze. Yeah. Banks stopped lending to each other because nobody knew who was holding toxic subprime mortgages.
Total panic.
Total panic. And the Fed's immediate reflexive response was to grab their traditional steering wheel. They aggressively bought securities to flood the system with liquidity, driving their target for the federal funds rate all the way down to a range of 0 to 25 basis points.
Which is just between 0 and 0.25%.
Right.
Basically, the absolute floor. They made borrowing as cheap as mechanically possible.
But the economy was in total free fall. Pushing the overnight borrowing rate down to 0.25% simply wasn't enough to thaw out the frozen credit markets and stabilize the broader financial system.
That just wasn't cutting it?
No. The traditional tools had reached their mathematical limit.
They ran out of room to cut, so they had to bring in the heavy machinery, which is where we get the term quantitative easing.
Exactly. Also known formally as large-scale asset purchase programs.
Catchy.
Very. The Fed realized that just tweaking short-term overnight rates wasn't working. They needed to force long-term interest rates down, things like mortgage rates and corporate bond rates.
To stimulate the broader economy.
Right. And to do that, they started buying massive, unprecedented quantities of longer-term U.S. government securities, as well as mortgage-backed securities from government-sponsored agencies like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
And the mechanical reality of how they buy those assets is the crux of this entire story, isn't it?
It really is.
Because when the Federal Reserve buys $1 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities from a major bank, they don't hand over pallets of paper cash.
No. No armored trucks involved.
Right. They just credit that bank's reserve account at the Fed with $1 billion. They create those reserves digitally, just out of thin air.
Yes.
So by executing years of these massive purchase programs, the Fed was inadvertently pumping an ocean of reserves into the banking system.
Which brings us back to that staggering statistic from the St. Louis Fed paper. Before the crisis in 2007, total reserves were around $15 billion.
Right.
By late 2014, after three distinct waves of quantitative easing, total reserves had skyrocketed to roughly $2.7 trillion.
Wait, hold on.
Yeah.
I have to challenge this for a second. If the Fed's main way of steering the economy is by buying and selling a few billion dollars of treasuries to slightly tweak the supply of money, what happens when there's nearly $3 trillion just sitting there?
That's the million or trillion dollar question.
Right, because doesn't the mechanism completely break? If the steering wheel is open market operations and suddenly there's a $3 trillion flood in the engine, doesn't the steering column just snap? I mean, buying or selling a few billion feels like pouring a cup of water into the ocean.
This raises an important question, and it really highlights the exact moment the old textbook became obsolete.
So I'm right. It broke.
You are entirely correct. The mechanism broke.
Rah.
Because there was now this massive, overwhelming abundance of reserves. The supply curve on our economic chart shifted violently to the right.
Past the cliff.
Exactly. It moved completely off that steep cliff we talked about and hit the totally flat horizontal part of the demand curve.
Wow.
When you have $3 trillion of excess cash sloshing around, no bank is scrambling at 4 p.m. to find reserves. Scarcity was gone. And without scarcity, those daily open market operations did absolutely nothing to the federal funds rate.
The steering column snapped. They had no way to control the temperature of the room anymore because the room had turned into an open stadium.
A giant, drafty stadium.
So to regain control, they needed a completely new tool.
And Congress recognized this vulnerability. They gave the Fed a new piece of architecture, and they actually fast-tracked the Fed's legal authority to use it, implementing it in October 2008.
What was it?
It's called Interest on Reserve Balances, or IORB. For the very first time in American history, the Federal Reserve started paying banks interest on the excess cash they held in their reserve accounts.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because this single policy change flips the entire incentive structure of the banking system upside down.
It totally does.
By paying interest on reserves, the Fed created what economists call a reservation rate. Let's translate that into everyday terms for a second. Think of IORB like a federally guaranteed minimum wage for a bank's money.
Oh, that is a highly effective way to conceptualize it. Minimum wage for money.
Right. If you are a bank manager today and you have $100 million in excess cash, your goal is to earn a return on it. In the old days, you had to lend it to another bank overnight to make any money, taking on a tiny bit of counterparty risk.
That's exactly.
But now the Federal Reserve steps in and says, hey, just leave your money parked in your account right here with us, and we will pay you a guaranteed 100% risk-free interest rate.
And it changes everything.
Why on earth would you, as a bank, take on the risk and hassle of lending your cash to a competitor for a lower interest rate when the central bank guarantees you a higher risk-free return for doing absolutely nothing?
You simply wouldn't. The St. Louis Fed paper explicitly highlights a quote from Fed Chair Jerome Powell explaining this exact dynamic.
What did he say?
Powell states that the Fed now uses administered rates to keep a market-determined rate, the federal funds rate, within a target range.
Administered rates?
Right. The IORB is an administered rate. The Fed doesn't rely on the messy chaos of supply and demand to find the rate anymore. They just pick a number, type it into the system, and set it.
And this administered rate acts as a powerful magnet through the financial mechanism of arbitrage, right?
Yes. Arbitrage is the secret sauce that makes this entire abundance framework function.
Walk us through it.
Let's walk through a specific hypothetical to see how powerful it is. Let's say the Federal Reserve sets the IORB rate at 2%. They are paying banks 2% to park their cash.
Okay. 2% minimum wage.
Right. Now imagine for some bizarre reason, the federal funds rate, the open market rate where banks lend to each other, somehow dipped down to 1.5%.
A smart bank manager sees a massive opportunity there.
A massive, completely risk-free opportunity. That smart bank would immediately go into the federal funds market and borrow billions of dollars from other banks at that super low 1.5% rate.
Oh.
Then they would immediately take those borrowed billions and deposit them directly into their account at the Federal Reserve, earning the 2% IORB rate.
That's brilliant.
They would sit back and pocket a guaranteed 0.5% profit on billions of dollars, carrying zero risk.
It's the closest thing to free money in the financial world.
Exactly. And because it's free money, every single bank in the system would rush to execute that exact same trade.
Right, they'd all pile in.
But what happens when everyone suddenly wants to borrow money at 1.5%? The sudden massive surge in demand to borrow funds would instantly drive the price of borrowing up.
It corrects itself.
Precisely. The federal funds rate would rocket upwards until it hit 2%, matching the IORB rate, erasing the arbitrage opportunity. Arbitrage acts like an inescapable gravitational pull. It ensures the market rate tracks almost perfectly with the rate the Fed administers.
So the Fed isn't painstakingly adjusting the supply of money by buying and selling treasuries every morning anymore.
Not at all.
They just walk over to the thermostat, punch in a new minimum wage for money, and the entire multi-trillion dollar banking system instantly adjusts itself to match it.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it means the Fed has fundamentally shifted their approach to the demand curve.
How so?
Instead of horizontally sliding the supply of money back and forth across a steep cliff, they are now just taking the flat portion of the demand curve and moving it vertically up or down.
Just shifting the floor up and down.
Exactly. If they want to cool the economy, they just raise the IORB rate. If they want to stimulate it, they lower the IORB rate. The size of the reserve pool is totally irrelevant to their ability to steer.
It is incredibly elegant, but, you know, as with any massive systemic change drafted in the wake of a crisis, there's always a loophole.
There usually is.
And the source material points out a major leak in this new bucket. Because while IORB works perfectly for traditional banks, not every massive financial institution operating in the U.S. economy is legally classified as a bank.
That was the glaring vulnerability in the early years of this transition. You have these massive, incredibly consequential entities like large money market funds, government-sponsored enterprises like Fannie Mae, primary dealers.
Heavy hitters.
Oh, absolutely. These institutions manage billions, sometimes trillions, of dollars in cash. But structurally, they do not have access to an interest-bearing reserve account at the Federal Reserve.
Ah, so they're not legally eligible to earn that IORB rate.
They can't get it.
Which means they aren't bound by that guaranteed minimum wage. If a massive money market fund has $50 billion in excess cash sitting around at the end of the day, and they can't park it at the Fed for 2%, they might be willing to lend it out into the overnight market for 1.8% or 1.5%.
And if they do that,
they could drag the entire federal funds rate down below the Fed's target, undermining the whole system.
Precisely. The Fed recognized they had to build a supplementary tool to plug this specific leak. So in 2014, the Federal Open Market Committee fully operationalized a facility with a very intimidating, highly technical name.
Let's hear it.
The Overnight Reverse Repurchase Agreement Facility, commonly referred to as the ONNRRP.
Okay, the acronyms in economics are always heavy, but let's strip the jargon out for a second. Tell me if this analogy holds up. The ONRRP facility is basically a hyper-secure overnight pawn shop for billions of dollars specifically designed for these non-bank institutions.
That actually captures the mechanics perfectly. Walk us through the transaction.
Okay, so it's a two-step overnight trade. Leg one happens today. A massive money market fund brings, say, $10 billion in excess cash to the Fed's window.
Right.
The Fed takes the cash and, in return, hands the money market fund a U.S. Treasury security to hold as collateral, like a pawn ticket.
Exactly.
Then, leg two happens tomorrow morning. The transaction automatically unwinds. The money market fund hands the Treasury security back, and the Fed returns their $10 billion in cash, plus a tiny predetermined bit of interest.
That is exactly the underlying plumbing. It functions as an overnight open market operation. Crucially, the Fed sets the interest rate for this ONRRP facility slightly below the primary IORB rate.
Okay, so if IORB is paying banks 2%,
the Fed might set the ONRRP rate at 1.9%.
And the logic there is the same as the minimum wage analogy. Because these massive non-bank institutions now have a guaranteed risk-free pawn shop where they can park their cash overnight and earn 1.9%, they will never, ever lend their money into the private market for anything less than 1.9%.
Precisely. It creates a rock-solid floor beneath the entire financial system. The IORB acts as the primary magnet pulling the federal funds rate up to the target, and the INRRP acts as the concrete floor preventing any non-bank cash from dragging the rate too low.
Together, they just box it in.
Exactly. Together, these two administered rates give the Federal Reserve complete dial-in control over short-term interest rates. And they can do this regardless of whether there are $3 trillion or $10 trillion sloshing around in the reserve system.
Which is brilliant in theory. But, you know, a newly designed engine isn't truly proven until it faces a catastrophic real-world environment.
Right. A stress test.
And in early 2020, the universe delivered the ultimate stress test.
The onset of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah.
When the global economy effectively shut down in a matter of weeks, the financial system faced a liquidity crisis that threatened to be even more severe and abrupt than the 2008 collapse.
It was terrifying.
Truly. Businesses panicked, markets crashed, and the demand for cash just skyrocketed. The Fed had to act immediately to prevent a total systemic failure.
And their response was incredibly swift, utilizing the exact framework we've been discussing today. They dropped their target for the federal funds rate straight back down to that 0 to 25 basis point floor.
Yep.
They slashed both the IORB and the RRP administered rates to near zero. And they aggressively fired up the quantitative easing asset purchasing programs again, buying up trillions in securities to keep credit flowing to terrified households and businesses.
And as a direct mathematical result of buying those assets, the level of reserves in the banking system ballooned even further.
Even higher than before.
Much higher. By April 2020, reserves surpassed $3 trillion, completely blowing past the peaks we saw following the Great Recession.
But here is the critical difference between the 2008 crisis and the 2020 crisis. In 2008, the sudden flood of reserves fundamentally broke the Fed's traditional scarcity-based tools, forcing them to invent a new system on the fly. In 2020, the system didn't break at all.
No, and what's fascinating here is how remarkably seamless the policy implementation actually was during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Because the Fed was already operating inside this ample reserves framework, the fact that reserves doubled almost overnight didn't disrupt their ability to steer the economy.
It just absorbed
it. The administered tools IORB and ONRRP worked exactly as designed. The steering wheel remained fully connected to the tires, easily handling an unbelievable amount of liquidity.
And the ultimate proof that the old world of scarcity was truly dead and buried came on March 26th, 2020.
What a day.
On that day, the Board of Governors officially reduced reserve requirements for banks to zero. 0%.
Just unbelievable when you think about the history.
Right. The very foundation of the old model, the idea that banks had to legally hold a strict, scarce percentage of their deposits, was officially wiped off the books. It had become totally irrelevant to modern policy implementation.
Which brings us full circle to that outdated textbook you mentioned at the very beginning. The foundational architecture has undeniably changed.
So what does this all mean for you, the person listening? We've gone on quite a journey today.
We really have.
We've watched the U.S. Central Bank completely rewrite its operational playbook. They transitioned from managing an economy through the delicate, microscopic scarcity of limited reserves to managing it through the overwhelming multi-trillion dollar abundance of ample reserves.
Exactly.
Instead of tweaking the daily supply of money, they now steer the macroeconomic ship using administered weights, setting a minimum wage for money through IORB, and building a concrete floor with the ONRRP pawn shop.
That's the new reality.
So the next time you hear a pundit on financial news talking about the Fed changing reserve requirements to fight inflation or referencing open market operations as the primary driver of interest rates, you'll know they're talking about a ghost ship. The old machinery is just gone.
But, you know, this transition from scarcity to abundance leaves us with a profound, lingering question to consider.
Oh, what's that?
Well, we've seen that the Federal Reserve transitioned to an abundance model out of sheer necessity during the 2008 crisis. And we saw that it proved to be an incredibly robust, vital, stabilizing force during the 2020 pandemic.
Right. It worked.
It did. But if the global financial system is now permanently anchored to ample reserves, if massive central bank balance sheets of $3, $4, or even $7 trillion are simply the new normal, what happens to the underlying value of money itself when the definition of abundance inevitably has to expand again during the next unforeseen global crisis?
Wow, that is a heavy, fascinating thought to sit with. If the engine is already completely flooded with fuel just to maintain a normal idle, what happens when you actually need to hit the gas?
It makes you wonder what the textbooks will have to look like 10 years from now.
It really does. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning what you read, keep looking for the mechanisms behind the curtain, and we'll see you next time.